Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, issued a warning about a new epidemic facing Americans, an epidemic of loneliness and isolation. And it's not hard to see what he's responding to. We're spending less time in places of worship, less time in community groups, and thanks to the pandemic, we're now even spending less time with our coworkers. So if loneliness is an epidemic, what's the cure? Well, today's guest has some advice that is simple, but not necessarily easy to follow. That advice? Hang out more. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Keith Menconi. So here we are, a few decades into the online age, a few years out from the start of a global pandemic. And right now, many of us are just trying to figure out how to live in this strange new normal. And also keep up some kind of a social life. Unfortunately, it seems that at least so far, we're not doing so well. Going back to some of the findings presented in that Surgeon General warning, whereas 2 decades ago, Americans were spending about 60 minutes a day with their friends, more recent figures have us down to about 20 minutes a day. And the pandemic seems to have only accelerated these trends. And this wave of loneliness does have health consequences. Vivek Murthy warns that socially isolated people suffer from higher rates of stroke and heart disease, along with depression, anxiety, and dementia. And beyond the stats and the figures, let's just state the obvious. Being lonely kind of sucks. It's no fun. That alone should be enough for us to want to fix this problem. So today on the program, we're going to hear from two guests who have been thinking a lot about what could be done to get us all hanging out more. Later on in the program, we'll be hearing from the founder of a startup that's opened up co-working and social spaces in San Francisco and Oakland, specifically geared towards helping members find more friends. Our first guest, though, is Sheila Liming, a professor at Champlain College who teaches literature and writing. She's also the author of a new book called Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. And she joins us now. Sheila Liming, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me, Keith.
Absolutely. So let's unpack that title a little bit, The Radical Power of Killing Time. How have we gotten to the point that the simple act of killing time together has come to be a radical act?
Well, I think when we think of that concept of killing time, we tend to think of it with a bit of a negative connotation in terms of like waste or else getting rid of something excess that we don't really need. But I actually think if we try to see it in terms of modern social activity, the killing of time is something that's pretty difficult to achieve. And the radical part comes in when you have to say no to certain things in your life in order to say yes to spending social time with other people. So whether that is organizing your calendar in a way to prioritize that kind of interaction and make sure that you have time for it, or whether it's actually, you know, thinking like, well, maybe I need to say no to a couple of things on my to-do list today in order to make time to see a friend or to talk to a neighbor or to interact with a coworker. So the radical part is the part that means that we have to seize something. And in the case of what I'm talking about in the book, the first thing that we have to seize is time itself.
Yeah. And we can talk about a little bit more as the conversation goes on, but it just feels like in so many ways, reclaiming that time is getting harder and harder for many of us, whether it's our attention that is getting stolen by the social media that we're on, or just this constant feeling that we need to be productive and doing something. All of that really takes us away from this restful feeling of being with other people. So let's return, though, to the big, bright solution that you have for all of this. That is the title of your book, Hanging Out. Talk in some ways, you say that this book is a manifesto for hanging out. So let's talk a little bit about what you mean by that phrase. It's such a familiar phrase, but as you point out, often goes underappreciated. What is the magic of hanging out? Why is it so critical?
Well, I was drawn to that idea or that phrase, hanging out, in part because of the connotations that come with it that involve like relaxation or a stress-free sort of interaction. Although, as I point out in the book, it's not necessarily always stress-free. Sometimes it involves a fair amount of discomfort or even work that has to be involved in order to do it too. But I define hanging out as daring to do not much and daring to do it in the company of other people. So basically just the idea of spending time with others and prioritizing the spending of that time with others in a way that doesn't necessarily have to have like a particular set agenda or a focus on a particular outcome. So you're not necessarily trying to achieve anything. You're not trying to produce anything. And it's not necessarily done in the context of like work or something that's going to get you ahead in life.
Right. And so as we've been pointing out, been getting harder to do that. How does that amount to, you know, a critical component in our social togetherness? How would you contrast that with the ways that many of us are spending time together now?
Well, you mentioned social media earlier, and I think that social media itself is actually in some ways a bit of a wishful thinking or utopian enterprise. A lot of what we do when we engage in social media is we're looking for connection. We don't always get it. Sometimes we find other things that stress us out or make us feel anxious on social media, but that's often what drives us to it in the first place. We're looking to get outside of our shell, and we're often looking out to get outside of the relatively lonely working environment that we spend a lot of our days in. So I think that wish, signals this desire on the part of many people that we do wish we could interact with each other a little bit more. We just don't know how to find the time or how to slot it into our already very busy schedule. So that's where hanging out comes into play, which is the idea of, setting time aside to exist in a non-productive, or at least not obviously productive, and unstructured way with other people. Whether that's just occupying and hanging out in like shared physical space, or whether that's, taking the time to have conversations with friends, with neighbors, things like that.
All right. Well, real quick, for anybody just joining us, this is KCBS In Depth. I'm Keith Manconi. Today, we're taking on the epidemic of loneliness in America, trying to figure out how we can make more friends. Joining us for this conversation is Sheila Liming, professor at Champlain College, who teaches literature and writing, also the author of the new book, Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. So social media, in some ways, it is giving us this fake version of hanging out. It gives us maybe the comfort of seeing familiar faces, but not actually producing that kind of close relationship that would be more socially nurturing. I'm wondering, it seems like this is kind of part of a broader trend in modern life that we are going for the easiest, most convenient version of socializing rather than the trickier, perhaps more inconvenient versions that would get us to something more wholesome and sustaining.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I try not to be too negative in thinking about social media because I do see it as a coping mechanism. And for many of us, it's been a pretty important one, especially during the pandemic, when it was actually difficult to hang out with people and occupy physical space with them. But there are limitations to social media, as you already pointed out, Keith. And some of those limitations involve the adoption of different behaviors. So for instance, if we think about the way that we interact with other people on social media, there's a level of control or of perception perceived control that sometimes comes with that. That idea that if you get into a conversation where you feel uncomfortable, or if you're interacting with someone and you don't like their attitude, or you disagree with their opinions, you can move away from that conversation really easily, effortlessly. You can, you know, close your browser tab. You can block that person if you don't want to talk to them anymore. And these are not behaviors that carry over into our daily life or into our professional lives. If you try to, you know, block a colleague who you work with in one way or another, that's going to have repercussions on your working life and your social environment. And it's, you know, similar when you encounter someone in face-to-face conversation who you don't agree with, you can't simply shut that person down and walk away from the conversation and act like it doesn't exist. There are different kinds of consequences to it. So one of the downsides of social media that I try to explore in the book is that feeling of control. And that the more we become reliant on those behaviors that we associate with social media, the more hanging out in person becomes difficult and it becomes uncomfortable as well.
So if we're looking for a way to reconnect, it sounds like part of the answer is being willing to accept more of that social discomfort as just the cost of deep, meaningful friendships and relationships. Where else should we be looking to recapture the magic of hanging out? I mean, is this a skill that we need to relearn? Is there more to it?
Yeah, I do think it's a kind of skill, and it's a skill that has to be exercised in order to remain robust, just like, you know, our muscles and our body. This is actually, you know, information that I took from Vivek Murthy from his book previously, where he talks about how the human body reads the situation of loneliness as a kind of biological emergency, that it looks for help or it looks for cover or it looks for shelter in the moment of doing that. So I think, yeah, it's important for our mental and our physical well-being to try to seek out interactions with other people and to live socially. But beyond that, one of the ways that we have to think about doing that involves existing in public space, entering into that public space, insisting on our right to be in it, and also resisting the charms or the lures of private space, which these days is just becoming so much more easier to access than public space as, you know, our public spaces continue to sort of diminish or to become difficult to exist in.
Well, this is an interesting point, and I feel in some ways personally called out in this, probably rightfully so, because I'm definitely, you discuss this at some length in your book, I'm definitely one of those people that goes to the gym and is always on his headphones. When I go out for a walk, I tend to be on my headphones too, and I just, you know, I'm a sucker for podcasts. I really like having that constant stream of information. I find it comforting, but you're right in pointing out that it does have a disconnecting force with you on the rest of the world. If anybody wants to talk to you, it's a whole rigmarole to realize that they're trying to talk to you, to take off the headphones, to re-engage with them. So it does put up this barrier. Are you suggesting that us headphone wearing folks out in the world are part of the problem here?
In a sense, yes. But I will also implicate myself there, too, because I am one of those people as well. And, you know, this book grew out of first a desire to kind of inspect my own behaviors and to think about how my behaviors either led me to enhance social interactions in my life or sometimes to diminish social interactions in my life. So it's not merely me calling out other people for this. It's also thinking about, you know, how I come into play here, too. I am also one of those people at the gym who is wearing headphones and listening to podcasts. And something I love is every now and then when somebody in that environment at the gym like tries to strike up a conversation with me, which happens very occasionally. And there's this whole awkward thing that happens with like the what and the taking out the headphone and then having the conversation and then like walking away from each other and putting our headphones back in that I think is just so interesting and so funny that we have to have this whole big production just to communicate basic information to each other. Like, is this machine broken or something like that?
It's a very 21st century social custom.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, just briefly, before we get on to the next part of our conversation, it sounds like part of what you're arguing for is recognizing the value of deeper social interactions, but also recognizing that there is a cost to pursuing those deeper social interactions. And what you're saying is that cost is worth it.
Yeah, the cost, as I see it, largely involves a heightened sense of discomfort, that there are going to be uncomfortable situations that you have to navigate and deal with as the result of making a decision to enter into the public sphere and to exist socially. But of course, there are benefits. There are personal benefits, as I already mentioned, and I think there are large-scale benefits with regards to democracy and to the functioning of our society, too.
All right. Well, definitely want to get into that a little bit later on in the program. But moving on now, we're going to bring on our next guest because, well, this feeling of isolation and loneliness is a problem throughout the country, but in some ways, it may be felt especially sharply here in the Bay Area. So, up next, we're going to hear about a very Bay Area solution to this set of problems. For that, inviting on the co-founder of Groundfloor. That's a startup with locations in San Francisco and Oakland that are a little bit like co-working spaces, but they are designed from the ground up to help members break out of their social bubbles and make new friends. So, welcoming on now Groundfloor co-founder Jamie Sneddon. Jamie Sneddon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. Good to be here.
So help our listeners visualize what we're talking about here at Groundfloor. There are spaces to work, a yoga studio, a gym, clubs, events, places to watch movies, play games. How does this all add up to friendships getting made?
Yeah, so what we realized in Groundfloor started as a personal response to my own isolation during the pandemic. Like many of us, most of us ended up working from home when the pandemic struck and realized about 6 months in that I was increasingly isolated and lonely. And so I started to try and go to other physical spaces to solve that problem. So I tried to work out of co-working spaces, tried to work out of coffee shops, and quickly realized that being around other people in a physical setting isn't enough. That's not actually how meaningful friendships form. You have to be in an environment where there's an element of trust, regularity, an element of curation, and that is very hard to replicate outside of a school, a religious institution, a workspace pre-pandemic. So what we try and do at Groundfloor is create physical spaces which do as good a job as we can to replicate what folks got so much value from in an office or a physical workspace or a school pre-pandemic. So you join Groundfloor, you go to orientation, you have a buddy, we get to know who you are, we understand what you're looking for, the types of things you're interested in, your passions in life, your working routine, where you live, and we're able to make really strong recommendations for other folk within the community for you to talk to. And as a member of Groundfloor, you get access to all the facilities that you were listing, but you also get access to clubs that are run by other members of our community. So what we've realized is that folks have got passions, interests, hobbies that over the course of the pandemic have been largely stifled, and they're looking for an outlet and a place and a community and a construct in which to rekindle those interests. So we allow our members to form their own groups, clubs around everything from cooking to sailing to archery, and that exists within the Groundfloor infrastructure. So as a member of our community, you get to access all of that as well.
And I also read that there's an AI tool that you're employing that helps figure out who might be most compatible with whom in these friendship groups?
Yeah, so I think our basic belief here is that there's been a ton of investment, capital, engineering minds put towards helping to find romantic relationships, whether you think of Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, and not a lot of attention and time given to try to find friendships and platonic relationships. And so if you do step out of your home into the big bad world, you're doing so largely flying blind. Mm. And if you're trying to find a friend, you're relying on friends of friends, maybe bumping into colleagues, folks, you're leaving it up to chance. And in 2023, that seems like a really unnecessary state of affairs. And so what we try and do is use data in a helpful and productive manner to better understand you and better understand the people around you in our community and help take the guesswork out of finding friendship. Because I think it's all well and good to say, well, you know, to feel better, you have to leave your house, but it really needs to be compelling and you need to know where you're going. And I think for most folks, they would agree that they need to be talking to more people. They need to be building more relationships. But just telling people to do that without a toolkit or the sort of infrastructure that makes that possible is really difficult.
Hmm. And to maybe zero in on exactly what role you're hoping these spaces will fill, I think I'll put a similar question to you that I've been kind of dancing around this whole conversation, which is just the question of, you know, why do we need so much help these days making friends? It just feels like there would have been a time and a place where you went out, you met your neighbor, friendships were formed, everything would be hunky-dory. And it doesn't feel that way anymore. It does feel like we need a little bit more help. Curious for your perspective, Jamie Sneddon, why it is that we need more help, and given that, what role Ground Floor can provide in giving that help?
So I think the pandemic definitely made things a lot worse. But if you look at the data over the past 30 years, we have been living increasingly isolated lives from about the mid-1970s onwards. And so the pandemic didn't create this problem, but it certainly heightened or exacerbated a lot of what was beginning to happen over the decades prior. And I think part of it comes down to simply where we spend our time. I'm an architect by training, so I've thought about physical space for as long as I can remember, from Legos up. And one thing I learned years and years ago was that the environments in which we spend our time truly dictates our happiness and fulfillment in many ways, but particularly in the context of this conversation, our feeling of connectedness to other people. So if you think about the 4 or 5 or 6 steps to your day, if you break it out into blocks, you wake up, you go to work, you have lunch, you come home, you have dinner, social activities in the evening. If you just think about where you do each of those activities, over the past 30 years, more and more of them have been conducted in isolation or at home. And so our belief is that our part to play in all of this is to give people more of a reason to leave home with more of a concrete outcome that they can anchor back to. Because we've proven over the past few years that work from home, from a productivity perspective, works fairly well, but from a social friendship perspective is quite catastrophic. And so to convince someone to leave home now, it has to be for a compelling reason. And it has to be because we help people do something outside of their four walls that's very hard to achieve at home. And it's easy to work from home, very difficult to make lifelong friends at home. And there's lots of virtual only solutions, you know, Bumble BFF and many others. They don't really work long-term, is our opinion, because you have to be around people for a series of weeks, if not months, in a repeated pattern. There's all this this construct that has to exist around two individuals for them to form a deep relationship on a friendship level. So we think our part to play is to help rebuild the physical space in which folks may have spent their time pre-pandemic or you know, for the years prior to that.
All right. One more time. This is KCBS In Depth, your weekly deep dive into the events and trends shaping life in the Bay Area and beyond. I'm Keith Menconi. Today on the program, have we forgotten how to hang out? We're considering why the world has gotten lonelier and what to do about it. Joining us for that conversation, speaking with Sheila Liming, a professor at Champlain College, whose new book is Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. Also just heard from Jamie Sneddon, who co-founded the Ground Floor Social Club, locations in San Francisco and Oakland. So bringing Sheila Liming back into the conversation, I know that you think a lot about how public policy could address this epidemic of loneliness, the role of public places. Hoping we can get into that a little bit more now. Obviously, for the past several minutes, we've been speaking about a private place, a private club. And, you know, we didn't get into this much in the conversation, but it does, you know, have membership fees. There is also scholarships to help less affluent folks afford to join. But ultimately, you know, it is a private club with a fixed membership. What are some of the public solutions to the loneliness crisis? What did you have in mind there?
Well, they would look like some of the institutions that we're probably already familiar with, but which have been increasingly in peril over the past several decades. So I'm thinking about the concept of third places, as was developed by the sociologist Ray Oldenburg in the 1990s. And he identified third places as places that exist apart from our first places, which are our home, and our second places, which are our place of work. There's something outside of both of those environments that you can enter into for either free or for very low cost, and where you're going to meet people who are not necessarily exactly like you. So not the people who you live with and not the people who you work with. This, very importantly, is also supposed to include people of different age groups. So people who might be retired, children, families, everything like that. So these places would include spaces like coffee shops, which Jamie brought up, or also places like libraries or parks, or even once in American culture, you could argue that shopping malls once provided this role in our culture too. If you think about the mall walkers of the shopping mall era, then you can kind of remember like how different people used those spaces aside from simply shopping in them too. But over the past couple of decades, we've really seen the curtailment of these more public spaces that people can enter into for free or or for low cost, which I think is what has in part inspired this response in the private sector to try to fill the need that these public institutions used to exist to fill. Part of what I argue for in my book is, of course, the reclaiming of those public institutions and the public spaces that we once had, to insist on our right to still have them, which is becoming really, really difficult with the encroachment of private space.
And so we only have a couple of minutes left, but I suppose just to assert the stakes for this conversation, even beyond the loneliness aspect of it and what we have already talked about in terms of health, mental health consequences, you referred to this a little bit earlier that there are even consequences for our democracy, our ability to come together as a unified people of citizens. Expand on that, if you could. Why do you see that as also being part of the radical nature of hanging out?
Well, I think democracy hinges on a number of habits and behaviors that we have to get used to. But one of them is the idea of not treating difference as a personal threat. So we have to be able to interact with other people and to assess difference where people are different from us without necessarily feeling like it's something that threatens us personally or is going to take something away from us. And then the other idea that comes from that, too, is the cultivation of care, the cultivation of care for people who are different from us, meaning people who do different jobs, people who look different from us, who live their lives differently from us. We have to be able to care about the way that those people function in society too. We have to be able to want them to have access to things like schools and roads and libraries and all those things in order for democracy to really function. If we stop caring about each other, then we stop caring about the democratic project.
Yeah, some weighty consequences there. Jamie Sneddon, we'll give the closing thought to you. So if the project is cracking the code of friendship, figuring out how to make friendships more viable, easier to make. Are we getting any closer to that? Are we getting closer to finding solutions to this epidemic of loneliness?
I think there's a lot of really interesting solutions bubbling up all over the country. I think there's a lot of really local efforts on a grassroots level. Oftentimes, folks coming together in communities that maybe did have a strong sort of public space historically, and don't anymore, and folks are, you know, reclaiming those spaces. I think that there's an exciting opportunity for folk to really think deeply about the science of why friendship forms, and there's an opportunity to apply some technology in a meaningful, helpful way to make this easier. I think there's been a kind of revolution in how people find their romantic partners over the past 5-10 years, for better or for worse. And I think there's an opportunity now to understand if you are at home and you don't have easy access to some of these public institutions that we've been talking about, which sadly have been in decline, what toolkit can we give to someone to do more than just say, hey, you should really leave home and hang out? I think it's about giving people access to something which is practical and helpful, because not only are we lonely, but we're also starved for time and attention. And I think there is an opportunity to be really pointed with giving people practical tools to make things easier. So we're trying to do our bit in the places that we operate. And there are examples of other ways, other formats of doing this in other places across the country as well. But I think it's critically important. And if we wait for public sector, to do this, we'll be waiting a long time. So I think that's the exciting opportunity as we see it.
All right. We'll close out there, speaking today with Sheila Liming, once again a professor at Champlain College, also the author of the new book, Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. Sheila Liming, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And we heard from Jamie Sneddon, who co-founded the Ground Floor Social Club. Jamie Sneddon, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Keith Menconi. Be well. We'll talk again next week.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.